You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
I'm Karina Lesser. I'm the Artistic Director of Scripps Presents, the public programming series at Scripps College. And I'm delighted to welcome you here for an evening with Rachel Kosk and Ann Friedman. All year long, the college, under the auspices of Scripps Presents, hosts writers, artists, performers, and scholars at our campus in Claremont as a way to provide a forum for community engagement and the exchange of ideas beyond the classroom. We're so pleased to partner with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles to bring Rachel Kosk's distinctive voice and literary perspective to Southern California and to play a role in creating space for conversation here in downtown LA. For us, it's a rare and exciting opportunity to share our mission with a wider audience, and that includes not only our students, I think there are a few of them here tonight, but also our alumni and Los Angelinos as well. We hope we'll get to host you on our campus one day soon. We have folks like Samin Nosrat, Nathaniel Rich, and a few other to-be-named literary superstars that are coming our way in 2019. So stay tuned. Until then, I'm pleased to introduce Jessica Strand from the library, who will introduce tonight's guests. Welcome.
Good evening. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. The Library Foundation, in partnership with the Los Angeles Public Library, is helping to define the library of the 21st century, a place that is bigger than a building and more than books, a place that facilitates equal access to information and ideas and helps to nurture literacy and creativity in all. If you are interested in supporting the vital work of the Los Angeles Public Library and attending more programs, you can become a member of the Library Foundation tonight. Just visit us in the lobby after the program. Now for tonight's event. We are very pleased this evening to be in partnership with Scripps Presents and in hosting author Rachel Kosk in conversation with journalist Ann Friedman. Rachel Kosk has written 10 novels and 3 works of nonfiction. She has won and been shortlisted for numerous prizes, including the Whitbread Award, the Orange Prize for Fiction, and the Goldsmiths Prize. Critics and writers alike have much admired her trilogy. Lori Moore and the New York Review of Books writes, "What runs through her trilogy is a coolly abstracted consciousness organizing all stories, one that is alert to the mendacity and, as the trilogy suggests, if they are any good, the cruelty in stories in a culture that glibly claims to value them. It is like reading the best kind of philosophy, steely, searching, brisk." Or as Judith Thurman in The New Yorker describes Kosk's recent work, Kosk's recent novels, "It isn't the drama of the events, but the specificity that keeps you riveted. Many experimental writers have rejected the mechanics of storytelling, but Kosk has found a way to do so without sacrificing its tension, where the action meanders, language takes up slack, her sentences hum with intelligence like a neural pathway." Tonight, she's in conversation with Ann Friedman, who writes about current topics such as gender, politics, and media. Her work has appeared in many periodicals, including The New Republic and The Guardian. She's a contributing writer to NewYorkMag.com and to the Los Angeles Times. Along with her journalism, she's the co-host with Aminatou So on the podcast, sorry about that, called My Girlfriend Friedman and So are at work on their forthcoming book entitled Big Friend, which will be released in 2020. Please help me to welcome Rachel Kosk and Ann Friedman to the stage. Many thanks.
I'm very excited to talk about this trilogy tonight. The novels Outline, Transit, and Kudos were introduced to me by my friend Jay Ryan, who told me that they changed how he thought about fiction, which is an incredible endorsement. I ran to the last bookstore and bought a copy of Outline. And I'm wondering if these novels represent a shift in your own thinking about what fiction can do, or maybe what it should do.
Well, I think they were... I suppose a reaction and also an action on my own part, in that the forms that I'd been working in, you know, for however many years that was, didn't. I mean, to an extent, they malfunctioned. I mean, I wrote some things in memoir form, which had the effect of making people incredibly angry and seemed to exist as a provocation, which, you know, was not at all my intention. And I think probably a sort of scholarly over-reverence for the literary canon. I think I probably felt too polite or something to put that material into the kinds of novels that I was interested in writing. And in the end, I guess that required me to think of a new way of doing it, which sort of chimed with a frustration with the existing ways of doing it and a feeling that the novel had really gone a long way away from any relationship to truth, and that, in fact, disavowing the kind of personal verification of the author had become an actual value in contemporary narrative. You know, the idea that you've made everything up being a
value,
a sort of badge of honor.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's interesting to hear you use that word malfunction, because I don't know, it sort of surprises me. I expected you to say, well, if they don't like my honesty, screw them. Or, you know, I mean, and that's clearly not how you felt.
No, because I guess I felt that I was trying to reach people in a different way in that memoir form, and it didn't seem to me to be an argument, the kinds of things that I wanted to talk about. A lot of it seemed to be almost beneath consideration. So I guess it was that beneath bit, particularly of femininity and of, you know, the sort of life of a woman that was disclosing itself to me, you know, the older I got. I guess the main thing I thought was that those books would, well, yeah, be beneath people's consideration, that it was such lowly subject matter. And that in itself was problematic. So I think that the sort of the seeds of this trilogy were planted a long, long, long time ago, in precisely that, I suppose, I don't know, internally misogynizing sort of attitude to
reaction to the memoir,
yeah, to my own material.
Well, it's interesting because there's a passage in Aftermath where you talk about story and truth and the difference between those things, and I'm wondering, hearing you say that, if this trilogy is an attempt to grapple with that question, or maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, the thing that I wanted to represent, which was the sort of collapse of a belief in reality, or I suppose more accurately, the belief in the story of your own reality. Since that essentially is trying to represent a sort of loss or an absence or a minus, a negative, and a book is a plus and a positive and a thing that, you know, exists in space. Trying to work out how a literary form could do that. Mm. And I suppose the seed in Aftermath, the beginnings of sort of grappling with that idea was marriage, I suppose, as an example of a reality, a thing that you believe in, that you sustain by your belief, and that actually to the sort of outside observer, the person kind of passing, is an invisible thing.
Right. I'm curious about how, if someone who has no idea about these novels approaches you and asks you a question like, so what's your book about? how you even begin to answer something like that?
Oh, I'm sure I have no answer. I always say that what I write is serious and
too serious
yeah,
for someone
serious
asking
and therefore
that question.
Not you know that tends to end the conversation very quickly.
Well, okay, so I will attempt to say that the series of encounters that make up the kind of thread that at least I believe to be following in these books have to do with strangers that our protagonist meets. And I'm wondering if the people who are talking to her about their lives and telling her stories, if they have anything in common in your mind, if you sort of have an archetype of like, oh, this is the passerby who's coming in and out mm-hmm. of these books and what
well,
qualifies
I mean,
them?
It's a chorus, really. It what that chorus sort of singly and communally represents is something that is halfway between the silence of thinking and the concreteness of writing. Mm-hmm. A lot of the people in the books sort of want to be writers or are doing a writing course or are thinking and talking about writing. And it's writing that's where I've really wanted to situate all three books is mm-hmm. is in the place where everybody could be a writer. Everybody believes they have something to write. They have a book. And why a book? Why is that the thing that answers this feeling that mm-hmm. that one could utter oneself? So that utterance. In fact, if we're talking about sort of irritating or unanswerable questions, the one would be, oh, people don't really talk like that. Mm. That's the sort of criticism that you could make of these books because these monologues are lengthy. And so I suppose that semi-naturalism, that's a very deliberate sort of technique on my part. But I think it is what a human in the grip of their native grasp of form, which I believe every individual has in relation to their own material, their own personal testimony. I think that's what that voice sounds like.
Mm. Yeah, everyone sounds epic to themselves, mm. right? I'm curious about... So. I've read several things that describe these as passive novels or that use the word passive. And it's really baffling to me because I sort of think of Faye as like the world's most active listener who is drawing inferences and selecting details and doing all these things to benefit us, the reader. And I'm curious what you think about that. Is she passive?
No, it's just that there's a big bit of conventional narrative that isn't in the books. So the person reading the book has to be active. But that doesn't make the book or the narrator passive. It just means that the part where you are told things as if you don't know them, as if you have never, mm-hmm. as if you have no knowledge of anything and you're just going to very passively sit and hear about what Paris looks like or what a person standing up and leaving a room looks like mm-hmm. or... So that feigned ignorance is mm-hmm. is what is missing from the book, and that makes the narrator seem very passive, because she isn't narrating; she's witnessing.
Well, it's interesting because many writers believe, or it seems like many writers are trying to get you to know their characters more deeply. The goal is, I'm going to tell you everything that Faye is thinking so that you see her as a fully realized human or person or persona. And it seems that you're sort of operating with the opposite goal of how far away can I keep her from the reader? Maybe not. I don't know. Are you trying not to let us get close to her? Or
I just don't think that that's how. I mean, I wanted the book to have a very. I mean, if only for myself to correct the relationship between narrative and truth, and or between language and truth, and you know there are enough examples every 5 seconds in our world at the moment of the drift of language away from truth, and what happens when those two things are allowed to separate. And my concern being literature, that's where I've seen that happening. And it seemed to me that it had to be possible to write something it's better known in the sort of genre of autofiction, mm-hmm. That the writer uses their own self to verify, you know, literally mm-hmm. as a safeguard against precisely this, you know, this sort of making things up, and that's a very misunderstood genre, I think. Mm-hmm. It's seen as sort of representative of the self-obsessiveness of, you know, a particular generation. But I think it's very much the reverse. But I, in a way, I didn't have that kind of mind and if I could have written my memoirs, for instance, in that style, they might have been more defended. But I was trying to bring that sensibility to the novel and to say, well, okay, if we're going to operate by this path of verification, in truth, how much does a person, how real is anyone to themselves? How real is your own past and your memory to you in the moments that you're living? It isn't a chronological sequence. Very often, the way in which you are made most real to yourself is what you notice. And I guess, the third book, by the time I, arrived at the third book, I kind of accepted that probably meant it was impossible to ever attain objectivity, even this narrator's attempts to see things objectively, in the end, she creates an image of herself by what she hears and sees.
Absolutely. I mean, I also think that I sort of adopted this posture of like a detective, and by the time I'd hit book three, I was like, oh, so she's interested in that about that person, and this is, drawing the portrait in relief. I'm curious about the word outline and whether it has anything to do with this idea you're talking about, or what meaning that you impart.
Well, it was I have this sort of theory that if you don't think of a name for a book before you start, it will never have the right title. It'd be like trying to name a child when they're sort of 10 years old. But I did come up, the title came sort of at the end of the book because it was an image that I use at the very end to describe, in a sense, this same process that I've just been talking about of almost a person being defined by the things that are outside them, and not what's inside them remaining ultimately mysterious.
Do you think that's true of everyone, or particularly true of writers who are hell-bent on noticing details and using them for their own ends?
No, I mean, I never notice anything. I'm the least observant person, so no, I don't think that.
I'm wondering if you might want to read a little bit from Kudos.
Yeah, so I could I'll just read a short passage for those who are unfamiliar with these books and their slightly strange style. This is a short monologue by a woman who is showing the narrator through taking her on a walk through the center of a European city and wants to show her an interesting sight. She's called Paula. "It is a little strange what we are about to see," she said as we walked. "I found it by chance a few years ago. I was passing nearby, and the strap of my sandal broke, and so I needed somewhere to sit and fix it. I saw that this church was open, and I went inside, not thinking anything about it, and I got quite a shock. Some 50 years before," she said, "the church had been ravaged one night by a terrible fire, whose intensity was such that the very stones had lifted, and the leading of the windows melted away, and two of the firefighters had lost their lives putting it out. But instead of restoring the church, the decision was made simply to repair the structural aspects of the building, which continued to be used as a regular place of worship, despite the disturbing extremity of its appearance and the violent events to which that appearance testified. Inside it is completely black," she said, "and the walls and ceiling are warped like the inside of a cave, where the layers of stone have expanded. And the fire, even while it devoured whatever paintings and statues had been there, left everywhere a patina of its own, in which one believes one can glimpse ghostly images. Everywhere there are these strange half shapes, like melted wax, and then in other places sheared areas where the stonework was split into two by the heat, and empty plinths and alcoves where things are missing. And the texture of the whole thing is so densely affected that it is almost no longer man-made, as if the trauma of the fire had turned it into a natural form. I don't know why," she said, "but I find the sight of it extremely moving. The fact that it has been allowed to continue in its true state," she said, "when everything else around it has been replaced and cleaned up, has a meaning that I am not quite able to understand or articulate. And yet people continue to go there and act as if everything is normal. At first I thought that someone had made a terrible mistake," she said, "in letting it stay like that, as if they thought no one would notice what had happened. And when I saw people inside praying or hearing mass, I thought it was indeed possible that somehow they hadn't realized. And this seemed so awful that I wanted to scream at everyone there and force them to look at the black walls and the emptiness. But then I noticed," she said, "that in certain places where statues had obviously been, new lights had been installed which illuminated the empty spaces. These lights," she said, "had the strange effect of making you see more in the empty space than you would have seen had it been filled with a statue. And so I knew," she said, "that this spectacle was not the result of some monstrous neglect or misunderstanding, but was the work of an artist."
I'm curious about whether you envisioned this as a trilogy when you began writing it, or if you knew exactly how many books, or was there a plan?
Well, I mean, I wrote Outline in a state of great isolation and for numerous reasons, sort of distance from even my own sort of literary world and history. And then it took this, you know, very strange sort of form and shape, and what I thought about that was that very probably nobody would be able to read it because it seemed so odd. So I think I wouldn't have been able to imagine doing kind of more of it. But then people did seem to understand it, and I guess I felt that I had only really sort of arrived at the very sort of shores of what I wanted to say, and I wanted to see if the form would allow me to do more than just be sort of drifting and detached, and whether it could actually express things like anger, whether it could talk about cruelty, for instance. And so that became the sort of goal of the next two books.
It's really interesting to me to hear you talk about the form as sort of separate from you, because, you know, I read these and I think, oh, she's created this brilliant way of doing this thing. And I think of you as the author, as the creator, not as a form exists over here. I'm curious about, does it feel, how does it feel separate from you?
Well, I guess I see writing as extremely technical. So, I mean, to me, it really was something, well, technical and you know, language as a moral system that I have utter faith in. You know, once I had understood what, to me, went wrong in a sentence or a paragraph or and saw that you could take it out, then the actual writing of it is much less important in a sense to me than that initial technical sort of grasp of what it is that I'm doing.
Were there moments during the process of writing any of these three novels where you noticed a large malfunction? Something big had to go or change or...
Yeah, I wrote this book. I wrote half of it and realized I'd done it wrong. So I had to throw it away.
How did you reach that conclusion?
Oh, it wasn't working. Any writer knows this. And one of the things about getting older, I mean, for anyone in life, you know, as much as for... doing something like this, what you do is less mysterious to you. I mean, when I wrote my first novel, it literally seemed to have sort of fallen into my head from outer space. And after I wrote it, I thought, I wonder if that will ever happen to me again. And, you know, if another novel will ever come. And you know, now I understand so much more about what I'm doing. But no matter how much you know, it can just stop. It can run out if you haven't sort of designed it properly, I guess. Mm.
So Kudos is the only book of the trilogy that has an epigraph. Is that right? Or do I have...
Yeah.
Okay. And it's a poem by Stevie Smith. She Got Up and Went Away. I'm curious why you selected it and why have an epigraph at all for the last
one? Yeah, it felt like a moment of weakness, definitely.
I loved it.
I'd been very determined to depersonalize these books as much as possible. No author photos and, you know, no nothing. But, it seemed so... the fact is I had it pinned in front of my sort of writing space because it was so the encapsulation, I suppose, of because writing this book, you know, I'm trying to end not one book but three, and how to steer to that ending, even though I knew what the ending was, but that poem was a sort of encouragement, I guess. It just reminded me, it always put me back in the tone of, and I actually think it was something as simple as that when I had it always typed at the beginning of the manuscript, and I think it was so simple that I forgot to take it off when I
you accidentally
when I sent it, and then there it was in the proof, and I thought, oh, well, you know, I'll let it stay there because it'd be nice for other people to read it too. It meant so much to me.
Do you have it memorized?
No, probably, but I'm not going to prove it.
I'm curious about, say a little bit about why it resonated so much or why you sort of kept it literally in front of you.
Well, I think poetry it's really easy to forget as a novelist if you're deep in the feeling of serving, you know, the novel as it's understood or desired to be by apparently the majority of people. And you know, I still am amazed, even though I've made it completely clear by having written three of these books, you know, what it is that I'm doing. That I mean, I don't read many reviews, but when I do look at one, within the first few lines, the person will always say, of course, there's no plot to speak of. And I think, you know... No, there isn't, but I think that really, I suppose, proves or shows how much a writer would have to get out from under, you know, to dispense with that stuff. And it's very easy when you're laboring under that structure to forget how extraordinary poetry is. Mm. And how nimble and free, free to be abstract, free to say the most sort of glimmering things that are the opposite of the sort of pedestrian narrative sentence. So, yeah.
Do you find yourself in your own time, for your own pleasure, reading more poetry than pedestrian narrative?
I don't read as much poetry as I should, actually. And I don't read very much sort of fiction at all anymore, because I think I've slightly wrecked it for myself. with all my not believing in things. I almost wish I could be the person who has not read the things that I really have loved so that I could enjoy reading them again. But
meaning that you would just not love them in the same way after going through this process of finding this form?
Yeah, I think it's probably, I mean, I think for anybody, you know, I think most people are familiar with reading again something that they revered in, you know, at another time of their life, or vice versa, reading something they didn't understand and suddenly seeing a new value in it.
Right, makes you question your younger self. Oh, I liked this. Embarrassing.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, you want a writer to be better than you, I guess, and part of that would be staying the same over time. Amazingly, very few writers do.
Any that leap to mind?
I think D.H. Lawrence, who is my probably my biggest sort of literary parent, he's stayed pretty much the same for me. Mm.
There, you mentioned earlier that there is so much in all of these books about writing. There are writers, they're writing students. I'm curious about where teaching writing fits in with your life and your practice as a writer, if it's something you enjoy doing, if you feel like it helps you get closer to the things that you want to do, or whether it's a distraction that pays the bills.
Oh, well, I don't do it. And
not anymore.
No, which is why my bills are, yes, unpaid, possibly.
Great.
But the way that I use that world in the books is partly as a, I didn't want the reader to, I mean, one slightly irritating thing that I seem to have done to myself is create an area where it's very easily assumed that I am the thinly veiled narrator of these books, whereas in fact my intention was simply to not ever cause the reader of the book to try and work out what my own relationship to the material was, or sort of who I was, or that I wanted to write about a world that just looked like it would be mine. Mm. And it seemed to me that the literary world, with its rituals and pomposities and rivalries and, you know, boring things you have to do and meetings and time away and da da da, was pretty much like any world. It probably had the same power structures and the same relationships. So the teaching part of it was kind of useful in that, and I mean this is true in life as well, in that it provides a completely visible surface for writing, for the actual writing process, that people talk as opposed to write. So usually if you're a writer, you're not talking, and you're not talking about writing. To have people talking about this thing is, you know, very useful, obviously, for my book, but I think it's something that that anyway is useful in my own experience when, you know, life has, you know, usually because of domestic sort of roles and, you know, life has got so little in it that has anything to do with writing and talking about it. So I've often found that to be a chance of to communicate, I guess, about the things, you know, that I care about.
Yeah, going back to what you were saying earlier about the ways that the memoirs were received in part because of this subject matter, and then looking at what appears to me to be incredible, like, critical reception of the novels, do you think that there's more space for women in particular to be honest with fiction as the vehicle as opposed to memoir?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it is still a mystery to me why, even though I'm meant to make it happen, and even though I reckoned that this would be the result, but why the same material presented in these two different ways provoke these two very different reactions. And I think it must have something to do with who owns it, where the ownership lies in any text. And so I guess that's not really a thing to do with whether it's fiction or a memoir, or it's how much the author can be blamed, credited with whatever. But essentially used as either a target or a vessel for other people's feelings about, you know, what these subjects are in their own lives. And, you know, something like motherhood is, you know, it bristles with taboos. To walk through that without upsetting or annoying people is, you know, pretty much impossible.
Absolutely. Well, and not just walk through it, write about it. I am going to open it up to questions from all of you imminently. So think about them. I'm sure you have many. And if you don't, I have pages. I want to talk a little bit about the ending of Kudos, not to pack all my gender questions on the end. When you said earlier, I sort of knew where I wanted to end up. How specific were you being? You know,
completely, yeah. No, I was very clear about what the ending was, but having to connect it to so I sort of probably knew the ending before I knew anything else about the book.
Why do you think that is, or what is it about that particular scene? Which, I don't know, maybe you could describe it a little bit, or maybe, I don't know if you want to read a little bit
more. Spoiler alert.
I read the reviews. I heard there's no plot, so I'm not worried.
This is the three books are such a journey through the question of gender and family life, and are the institutional representations, and take out even institutional, are the representations of humanity, human life and relationships better? Is it better to just go with them, like wearing a school uniform, or, you know, versus wearing your own clothes to school? Is it better to live in those forms? And what does life look like not in those forms? You know, the search for freedom, the desire for freedom, is, you know, not just in my female characters, but that particular feminine desire for freedom is something that I am extremely interested in and engaged by, and whether it is ever and at all possible for a woman to be free, and what is it? What is this, you know, utterly unnameable freedom that a woman wants? Are you better off looking for it in the institutional marriage? Is that, you know, like, is that like people sometimes say about arranged marriages, that actually, you know, it kind of works better than the kind where you choose? And I don't have an answer. And my answer was an image in the end, which is the image that the book ends on, of essentially man and woman in two separate but completely interlocked elements, with essentially, you know, some, I suppose, force issuing from male to female, some, you know, something that needs to be received and contained and dealt with one way or another and can't be run away from. That in the end it is a completely ambivalent relationship, and either you can live with that or you can't.
All right. You all have a chance now. I don't know where the mics are, but they will come around to you. So if you have a question, put your hand up and someone will find you.
Question over here. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
You mentioned D.H. Lawrence, which really surprised me. Who else is in your pantheon?
Why did it surprise you?
I guess I associate his writings with a deep, detailed lushness, and I see yours as far more philosophical and spare, frankly.
Mm. Well, what?
Not that you couldn't have inspiration, obviously, from that direction, but it just surprised me. So then I wondered who else you're drawing from or inspired by.
I think I'll defend Lawrence instead of admitting rivals to him. I think it's possibly slightly harder for a non-English person to really get the strangeness of Lawrence's voice, because what is strange about it is that it's a working class voice using a very sort of beautiful sense of art and literary form, and it. I guess what I got from him was the realization that you could break sentences and just go off somewhere completely different, and his sentences travel miles, you know, from the first word to the last. He can get you, you know, the most extraordinary distances, and that seemed to be because he didn't have a sort of preformed sort of language and grammar. And I suppose that's something I've worried about so much myself as a writer, and really finally have tried to kind of get away from in these books, which are written in kind of global English, essentially, sort of Google Translate English. So that feeling that you are almost predetermined, and you can never actually even know how predetermined you are in the sentences that you're using. It's almost like they're using you. So for me, his appeal was very much about that power of just taking it and sort of throwing it over his shoulder and you know, making the sentence go where he wanted it to go. I have many other influences, too many to list.
We won't make you list them all. All right. I don't know where your next question is. Are there no other questions?
There's one over there.
Given what you just said about D.H. Lawrence, the first novel I read of yours was The Country Life, and which I loved. But to me, it seems like that's sort of like what you were talking about in a way, because you were taking sort of the British comedy of manners and turning it on its head. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the early kind of just talking about sort of spheres of influence as well. I was very sort of attracted by or magnetized by that very English type of black comedy, satire, Evelyn Waugh type of text. Because, I mean, I grew up here in Los Angeles and moved, my parents were English and we moved back to the UK when I was 8. And so the cruelty of the English, the cruelty of their social construct, the ways in which they use language to cut each other down to size, insult each other, and yet remain polite. It seemed to me that a writer like Evelyn Waugh had was writing out of such an experience of kind of internalized cruelty, and that this black comedy, this satire, was a way of laughing at the things that had hurt you, or laughing at them as a way of not letting them hurt you. And I think I felt much the same because I was arriving in this culture as a sentient observer and seeing, you know, finding it very new and strange. So The Country Life is my my Evelyn Waugh novel, I guess. My attempt at playing around a bit with that form.
Hi. You talked about how this recent trilogy, you were trying to sort of describe or talk about how one's story collapses in on itself. And it seems to me in your books, identity is not fixed or intrinsic. It's kind of determined by structure and context. I'm an aspiring screenwriter. I'm wondering, is there any way to do this in a film? Have you ever thought of this?
to not have a story.
I suppose, yeah. Or not have character, possibly. Or
I mean, I guess the question would be whether you felt the need to represent everything literally. I mean, part of what I'm doing in these books is using speech to I mean, I don't know very much about screenwriting. I know more about drama, but it's something that Chekhov, for instance, is really good at. A character, because his plays are fairly static and this feeling that you get also of people sort of marooned in Russia and the difficulty of sort of moving from, you know, one geographical landscape to another. And so there's so much talk about other places and describing of those other places. And I guess one of the ways in which I began to think about that economy, that you didn't actually have to go to the place and describe it as if no one had ever seen it before, that in fact you could just stick with the person telling you about it. So I don't see why you can do that in a film, but I'm no expert, so don't ask me.
Do you feel like you're part of a literary movement of autofiction? I mean, it seems like such a major formal innovation, your work particularly, but I'm thinking of writers like Sheila Hetty and Siri Hustvedt and Sigrid Nunez and even Elena Ferrante. It just seems like there's really incredible formal things happening, and I was wondering how you experienced that.
It's a really interesting thing to witness and to witness oneself coming to, you know, that essentially people are arriving at the same conclusions roughly at the same moment for very different reasons and in very different places. And that's never been my idea of what a movement was. I always thought a movement would be like a load of people sitting in a room saying, let's change our art, let's do this, let's have these ideas. Whereas in fact, it seems, I mean, to me that it really proves that this is a response. I think it's a response to what I was talking about at the beginning, to this sort of running away of literary values and of narrative towards a basis in the exception rather than the rule, in the most exaggerated example of a thing, the only example in the whole world of a thing, rather than an example that is universal and actually relates to people's lives. I think that, I mean, Nausgaard, who I think you mentioned, gives a, you know, there's a good couple of pages in I think the first of his books where, you know, he describes this feeling of being so sickened by made up stories in everything and everywhere he goes, everything he hears. And I've written a bit about that too, you know, to what extent almost your own experience of of reality, of being yourself, could be infected by this idea of sort of plot and story and so I think, you know, that to me, the fact that so many people without consulting each other have concluded the same thing. I mean, you know, some of those writers, Sheila Hetty, for example, I feel a sort of envy of, because I think that for whatever reason, you know, Sheila managed to arrive at her artistic sort of conclusion about all of this by a more, not having to live it so much, simply by just thinking about it, and not by such a long sort of vicissitudinous road of experience. So I think there's a kind of cleverness, a clever end of autofiction that is, it's true of those writers. They have sort of more in common with sort of critical theorists, and you know, it's just thinking, approaching this stuff from a slightly different angle.
The passage you read had a very allegorical feel to me for some odd reason, and I wondered if you ever found things larger or even contrary to your intentions emerging from what you write.
What, in terms of images and what they...
Or like an allegorical feeling to a passage, or...
Yeah, I mean, that's very much what I'm sort of trying to do, because... I guess I've wanted the to keep the surface of the prose totally rooted in sort of verifiable fact, in, you know, the things that I'm talking about being, you know, that anyone walking past could see what the book is seeing, could hear what the book is hearing, that there's no sort of private or kind of prior knowledge. So, you know, if that's how you're operating, then you have to really consider the ways in which people do see things. And I guess one of the things that I feel about this stage of life that I'm talking about, which I guess is midlife, you know, and the crisis of midlife, is that there is an artistry to it, that there's a sophistication or a wisdom or some bursting out of or overflowing of emotion and into one's engagement with reality, where in a sense you are becoming a writer, you are becoming an artist, you are seeing connections between things and seeing the significance of things and seeing metaphors in things. For me, the sort of rule of these books had to be that those things were in the world.
We have time for one more question.
I think you've already answered this, but do you find your writing liberating?
Do I find, the act of writing?
Well, the act and the result, the whole thing taken together. Do you feel liberated by what you're doing?
Oh, but I mean, I think all writers have exactly the same feeling of. It's liberating if it is liberating to have been completely tied up by the biggest ball of string that you can ever imagine and to have somehow managed to struggle free of it. That's pretty liberating.
Does it make you feel better? How's that?
So, alleviating, I guess, is the...
And on that note... thank you so much, Rachel, for being here tonight. And thank you for coming.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.